What I Have Learned, the second talk at Gutenberg College's 2014 Summer Institute and 20th Anniversary Celebration, was presented by Charlie Dewberry on July 31, 2014. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Some of the questions from the audience were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Dewberry's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
Okay, I think I'll get started. I'll make just a couple quick comments first. And again, it's really great to see everybody here. It's just phenomenal to see, for instance, all the alumni that took the time and through the expense of coming here to be part of this. It's really neat. And secondly, a lot of the comments I'm going to make are facts and things you've heard me say over the years. In fact, a number of them I held even before Gutenberg. But for me, the primary thing is a new context. Having been involved with Gutenberg, it forced me to think about education, not just my education, but education in general in America. Where is it going? And so I just wanted to make that comment, that that's the major thing that in the last 20 years I think I've gained a little bit of an understanding about. And that's what I'd like to share tonight. So during the last 20 years, what have I learned about teaching science seminars at Gutenberg? And already some of the alumni have come up to me and said, oh man, you remember those workshops like organic chemistry, counting Daphnia, all of those sorts of things. I've never forgotten it. In the initial formulation of Gutenberg College, the question how to incorporate science in the curriculum was one of the most difficult ones that we faced. Clearly, science needed to be part of the curriculum, but the question was how. Science has been an integral part of Western culture for the last 500 years at least. In fact, many would argue that science is Western culture's most unique feature. A second reality with regard to the science seminars was that many of our students came to Gutenberg deficient in science. Many hadn't taken science in their preparation for college. Others had some background in science, but they were poorly prepared. Lastly, many of our students had little interest in science. These realities were factored in designing the curriculum. In this paper, I will begin by very briefly talking about the historical context of the debate in education between a college, a liberal arts perspective, and a university perspective. A major element of the debate revolves around the role of science in education. As we designed Gutenberg, part of our decision was based on our take on this historical debate. Then, I'm going to describe what we initially decided we needed to accomplish science-wise in the curriculum. A major issue was, how are we going to address student deficiencies? Next, I'll talk about the evolution of the science curriculum over the years, and lastly, I'll give a critique of where I think we are now. I'll begin by making my brief comments about the historical context of education, especially in America. The forerunner of college arguably started in the schools of Plato and Aristotle. They provided instruction for young men prior to attaining the status of an adult. Their goal was to encourage them toward being virtuous citizens. This was opposed to the instruction provided by the sophist, which primarily was aimed at gaining advantage in courts for material gain. By the Middle Ages, learning centers such as Paris were taking on the appearance of modern colleges. They had recognized facilities, significant libraries, and facilities, and they had a more clearly defined curriculum that aimed to prepare students for their life's work, theology. The faculty were now licensed, limiting who could teach. This created a virtual monopoly on education within the Catholic Church. The beginning of American higher education starts in 1736 with the establishment of a college at Newtown, Massachusetts, which was renamed Cambridge, Massachusetts. This institution became Harvard when a Puritan merchant, John Harvard, gave half of his estate and all of his library, 400 books, to the developing college. Harvard's first graduating class consisted of 9 graduates. Their early New England colleges, such as Harvard, were based largely on Oxford and Cambridge because that's where the college-trained immigrants had been educated. About 1 in 75 immigrants in the 17th century had a college degree. This was the same ratio in America of college-educated people into the early part of the 20th century. The vast majority of these immigrants came from Emmanuel College, Cambridge, England. This was the center for education of the Puritans. Clearly, the purpose of the first American colleges was to train the clergy. However, according to Andrew DeBanco in his book, College, What It Was, Is, and Should Be, he notes that less than half of the 17th century graduates entered the ministry. In addition to theological courses, they received classes in logic and ethics, and that's classical as well as Christian ethics. Arithmetic and geometry were taught. In short, education in the 17th century was a liberal arts education. In his book on the history of Harvard, Samuel Eliot Morison states that the goal of education in the 17th century was to develop the whole man, his body and soul, as well as the intellect, toward the formation of a person inclined to unity, gentility, and public service. Even into the 19th century, American education was rooted in its liberal arts perspective. Ralph Waldo Emerson, certainly not an orthodox Christian, he put it this way: "Teachers have always been, and let us hope will always be, in the business of trying to get the soul out of bed, out of her deep habitual sleep." Well, looking then at the early development of American colleges, we see that they were based on a liberal arts education. For the purposes of this paper, a liberal arts education covered all subjects in balance. The aim was to help the students grow and mature into adults that have thought about fundamental questions like what makes a life significant. Is there a God? And in America in particular, religion continued to play a dominant role in education of the students. This curriculum also prepared students to become citizens. It was generally understood by the founding fathers that this form of education was necessary for the American experiment in democracy. In their view, education needed to foster a virtuous citizenry. John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, who probably agreed on nothing else, agreed that if education ever abandoned those principles, the American experiment would end very quickly. During the 19th century, there came a fundamental change in college education, unprecedented in 2,000 years. I will call this the German Research University. It's often called the Humboldt model after its founder, Wilhelm von Humboldt, based on ideas developed by Friedrich Schleiermacher. The goal of the university was to produce scientific knowledge as quickly and as efficiently as possible. The basic unit of education became the research scientist. His charge was to increase scientific knowledge. He was given freedom and research resources, such as well-equipped laboratories, to do his work. The graduate students did dissertations, which were usually published in scientific journals. All of this was accomplished by a high degree of specialization. The students' classes and experiences were all related to their narrow research field. With the development of these research universities, undergraduate education began to decline. A noted American university president once observed that the quality of undergraduate education at any given university is inversely related to the prestige of their faculty. The faculty and grad students are primarily charged with research, and undergraduate education is, from their perspective, an impediment to their research. Also, as time went on, undergraduate education became little more than feeder programs for graduate schools. There was a push to drive specialization into undergraduate education. This also drove a demand for more students, because economics demands that there be a large number of students in all these highly specialized classes. At the same time, the core requirements were minimized or totally eliminated. No longer was the goal of undergraduate education focused on the development of the students. The goal was primarily to increase scientific knowledge. In their undergrad programs, the students were counseled to specialize as quickly as they could and start preparing for the graduate level research work. Undergraduate education had now been transformed primarily into job creation. There's also a fundamental shift in philosophy between a liberal arts program and the German university research model. Andrew DeBanco, in his previously mentioned book on American college, points out that in a liberal arts program, knowledge of and from the past is transmitted to undergrad students so they may draw on it as a living resource for their future lives. While in the research university, the goal is to create new knowledge in order to supersede the old. In other words, in a liberal arts program, we look at history to understand the answers that have been previously given by individuals, and we can critically examine them to help us not only to learn from and about the past, but to help us face future conditions, situations that in some respects are similar. In the research university model, we start from where we are. All it has been built on the backs of previous researchers. We conduct research for the purpose of superseding all that knowledge. It is in that sense that science is always seeking to progress. The focus of science is on the future, not on the past or on the present. When I was in graduate school in science, the mantra was, don't bother to read any paper more than 5 years old. The goal is simply to keep adding and correcting today's knowledge. To close this section, I'll make a few editorial comments. Notice that what I presented in this section was a very brief history of education, but I was highlighting what I thought was relevant and important to critique where we are now. The issue that I'm interested in is not just what was education, but what it should be. We look at each stage of the historical development of education, we critique each stage. Then we use this analysis to help us not only to understand the development of education, but to critique the assumptions that were made at each major period of education's development. Through this process, we come to conclusions about what the right assumptions are about education. Any critical examination of education must start somewhere. There must be a starting point that are taken for granted to be true. Notice that the heart of the analysis I just articulated is a value judgment about the true view of education. This is largely the liberal arts approach to education, as opposed to the research university perspective on what education is. The research university perspective on education sees this all very differently. In their view, the only relevant question is, where are we now, and how fast can we replace our current knowledge with new knowledge? From the research university perspective, it doesn't really matter where we are now. And it doesn't matter where we've been, because where we are now is just a stepping stone to the future, to the new knowledge. And the new knowledge is what it's all about. That's what ultimately counts. It's the future that concerns us, not the past. From the research university perspective, their scientific method is the best and most efficient way to progress. Both the liberal arts approach and the research university approach have their strengths, and to begin with, I thought they had their place in education. The rest of this paper will be addressing the question, what's the place of liberal arts education and what's the place of a research university in education? My perspective has changed greatly on this over the years. At the present time, the university research perspective has largely all but superseded the liberal arts college approach. The purpose of this research university is new knowledge. The major funding for a research university is grants aimed at scientific research to solve major problems facing mankind. Their perspective has a long history, and it dates back to the Enlightenment. The goal of the Enlightenment was to replace traditional medieval values and methods with new scientific methods, and through science we'll solve all the major human problems. Through science we'll understand nature so we can control it and solve our problems. Starting just before the dawn of the 20th century, science became the only recognized knowledge. All other so-called knowledge was relegated to opinion. This perspective is the philosophical root of the modern research university. I'll now turn to the issue of how we thought about science education initially in the formation of Gutenberg College. When we began to put the curriculum together, one of the most difficult problems is how are we going to incorporate science into the program? Since we were interested in integrating all forms of knowledge and also helping the students see the connections between various fields, one partial solution was to select some science readings as part of the Western Civ and Great Conversation discussions. This solved part of the problem and fulfilled many of the aspects that we were interested in capturing. This approach is basically just the liberal arts approach to science. The major debate was how many readings in science should be incorporated into the curriculum, also what readings should be included. Many science readings or journal articles are written for other scientists and not for a general audience. Other readings might be readable, but they're still very difficult to have a discussion about. When we began to put the reading list together, it became clear that we wouldn't be able to include enough readings to address many scientific issues. This was particularly the case because a number of our students lacked a background in science. Therefore, we realized that just including science readings was not an adequate remedy for including science in our liberal arts program. We tried to balance the liberal arts perspective initially with a research university perspective. What and how much background can we give the students if they desire to enter a research university? How much background can we give them in biology and in physics? Today, the majority of education at high school and undergraduate level is to prepare students to enter the research university. In the research university model, you need to understand the current perspectives and current tools used to investigate nature. That's it. We were also aware that many of our students came to Gutenberg deficient in the sciences. A number of them hadn't taken many courses, and many of our students had little interest in science. As a number of them put it, well, I'm interested in the liberal arts. If I was interested in science, I'd have gone to the U. So initially, we decided that we would try to combine science reading in the curriculum with science workshops. We'd give them a number of basic tools in science so that they would have some understanding of the workings of science. For example, one of the tools we taught them was how to determine the equation of a line from a set of data points. This tool is the foundation of inductive science. The idea is to collect a number of data points, for example, what's the relationship of height of people to their weight. The information is gathered, and then the equation of line representing the relationship of height and weight is constructed. The line tells you the relationship between height and weight. The variation in your sample tells you how well the equation of the line explains the relationship between height and weight. The second example of a tool that we wanted to provide them with was how to compute a weighted average using spatially explicit data. For example, we gave them precipitation data from about a dozen gauging stations in the state of Oregon, and asked them to compute the average precipitation for the state of Oregon. The key observation was that the precipitation stations were not randomly distributed. Most of the gauging stations are in the Willamette Valley. Very few of them are in the High Cascades or in eastern Oregon. The students had to decide to weigh the locations of the sites to come up with a reasonable average precipitation for the state of Oregon. During a quarter, we would teach five or six of these tools. These are foundational tools that most all modern scientists would work with. This approach to science in our curriculum didn't work very well. First, as I mentioned, we didn't have enough readings in science to get the basic issues, scientific issues, across. There was also a lack of interest and background in science. It was very difficult to make much progress with these readings. It became clear that our initial approach to science in our curriculum was not working very well, and without giving the students some background in science, little was going to be gained by reading scientific works in the Western Civ readings alone. Our efforts to teach them the tools of science in these workshops was also not very successful. First, the students largely rebelled against the workshops. Most would acknowledge that the tools were something they should know how to do, and they were well aware that the workshops were primarily aimed at providing them with tools they should have learned in high school but didn't. There was also the issue of a general lack of interest at times in science. From their perspective, they were trying to avoid science in their education, and none of them were interested in scientific careers. These workshops did provide the students with some of the basic tools of science, but they didn't make much headway in understanding what scientists are really trying to do. In general, the evaluations of the science workshops concluded that they were boring, remedial, demeaning, and uninteresting. We listened to their concerns, but the fundamental problem with the structure of science was that the students were neither gaining much of an understanding of a liberal arts perspective of science, nor were they gaining much ground as far as what a research university perspective of science was. So they really weren't gaining much science either way. But truthfully, our fundamental critique of the workshops was that it didn't fit coherently within our liberal arts curriculum and our perspective on education. Over a period of a couple of years, we came up with a new approach. First, we pulled all the majority of readings out of the Western Civ and Great Conversation discussions and placed them in science seminars. During the freshman and sophomore years, we focused on the Copernican Revolution. We read the major contributions of Ptolemy, Copernicus, Descartes, and Newton. The focus of our interest was primarily answering the following questions. One, what was the major contribution of each scientist in replacing the Ptolemaic theory of astronomy by the Copernican theory? The second, for each author, what was their view of science, methods, and limitations? Third, how did their views compare with the modern view of science? Some of you might recall that some of these appeared on two-year exams from time to time. This approach is completely within a liberal arts perspective. We're looking at the past to understand different perspectives that each scientist had about science and how to do it. We're looking at their time, how the notion of modern science developed in their time. Everyone agrees that the Copernicans founded modern science. Remember, from the research university perspective, there's nothing to be gained by reading the ancients. All that matters is now and how science will progress by replacing the current view. The modern perspective is that science is testing hypotheses and replacing our current view with one that fits the empirical test better. That's all that modern science does. I'll come back to this in the next section when I critique our current seminar, but I can't help but drop a couple punchlines at this point. Our students quickly see that the Copernican project was very different than the modern science project. In fact, one of the responses by the Catholic Church was much closer to the modern perspective on science than any of the Copernican perspectives. This is astounding. Modern science is actually more in agreement with the Catholic Church than they are with the Copernicans when the question is, what is science and how do you do it? How can this be? Well, scientists no longer read the ancients, so they have no idea what the historical issues were. In their view, the only thing that matters is that we know more than the Copernicans did. That's the only thing that counts from their perspective. We beg to differ. As I said, I'll return to this in the next section. Also, the science seminar readings are designed to fit chronologically with our other Western Civ readings, so the students see the impact that Copernicans had in areas far removed from science. Remember, our goal is to integrate all fields of knowledge into one coherent whole. During the junior year, we trace the major developments in biology. We start with Aristotle, work our way through Darwin to Crick and Watson's discovery of the structure of DNA. Again, we're not only interested in the content of the theories, but we're interested in each scientist's view of what science is and how it's done. During the winter quarter of the biology seminar, we investigate population dynamics. A major component of this class is understanding the modern demographic models and their assumptions. The students learn to calculate major population characteristics from modern census data. One of the exercises that I have them do is track the trajectories of the populations of Germany and France from 1870 to 1950 and relate the population changes to historic events in each of the cultures. The senior seminar looks at Einstein's theory of relativity and quantum mechanics. Again, our goal is not so much to understand all the nuances of each theory, but rather how do these physicists view science, the methods of science, and science's role in culture. I think it's fair to say that our science seminars are now pretty unique within modern college and universities. Research universities would not read the Copernicans and ask what is science, its methods, or its role in culture. At least in my science training, what is science is what modern scientists do. The methods of science are testing hypotheses and publishing your research in journal articles. And scientific knowledge is privileged knowledge. It's more certain and objective than the knowledge anybody else has. Some would say it's the only form of knowledge that exists. Scientists then wear the robes of authority in our culture when the issue is what is true. The research university has a major stake in maintaining this position. Now I'll move to my critique of our science seminar project and what I've learned. I don't believe that any major science curriculum in the country places a high premium on questions like what is science, what its methods, and what should its role in culture be. But yet, I would argue that these are fundamentally the most important questions that ought to be asked of science. These are far more important than any particular research finding. Therefore, I think that today our science program is the best undergrad preparation for science, period. A scientist ought to be able to give good answers to questions like what is science, give a defense of its methods, and what are its limits in culture. Yet, if we look at it, very few scientists can give any significantly intelligent answers to any of those questions. Here's how to succeed in a research university model. As soon as you figure out what you want to do, preferably when you're in high school, start getting a background in math and science. When you get to your undergrad education, only take classes that will directly help you in your career. Next, study the literature and find the top couple of scientists in your field that you are interested in. Start interacting with those scientists and their grad students. Your goal is to get into their research program and their lab if they have one. This puts you into cutting-edge research. This will greatly enhance the possibility of success in the field. That's what I did, and I had the good fortune of working for a couple of the leading scientists in my field. stream ecology. Nowhere in my education, in high school, undergrad, or graduate school, was I ever required to take a single class that looked at any of these fundamental questions. In fact, I could have gotten my PhD, and notice that a PhD means doctorate in philosophy. I could have gotten a PhD without taking a single philosophy class. I don't think that things have changed since I was in graduate school in a research university. Something is also wrong if nowhere in your education you've ever been asked, define your field, give a critique of its accepted methods, and what are the limits of the field of study that you're in. My argument is that the modern research university produces technicians, not scientists. This is a profound criticism, so let me take a couple minutes to lay out my argument. The focus of most science research is at the level of a hypothesis. For instance, we want to see if a particular drug will cure a particular disease. So we set up an experiment with controls, collect data, run the statistics, publish the results. This is how modern science defines itself. Scientists focus on what they call the facts, which are determined by their research. In modern science, it's the facts that count. We want to know if this drug cures cancer. It either does or doesn't. We want just the facts. However, let's look back at the Copernican example. Everyone agrees that the Copernicans founded modern science, but what I want to ask is, what was their view? And here's the story modern science tells it. It's recorded everywhere. Everybody that's taken a science class has gotten this story. Copernicus reluctantly published his theory on his deathbed, and it fell to others to defend it. 50 or so years later, Galileo picked up the burden and defended the Copernican theory against the Ptolemaic theory. Galileo was persecuted for defending the new science, that is, observation and experiment, against church dogma. The churchmen refused to look through the telescope, which would have shown them the truth of the new theory. But if you actually read the transcripts of the trial and what Galileo argued to get himself in trouble, the story is actually about 180 degrees opposed to that story. And I'll provide two cases to show that these two theories were in fact empirically identical. So at the time the Copernicans were writing, the argument is that here's two theories empirically identical. What would modern science say about that? If you don't have empirical evidence, you have no grounds to claim a theory is true. Here's the two cases I'll make to show that the two theories at the time were empirically identical. First, Ptolemy and Copernicus based their theory on the same information, and that same information yielded the same basic result. In one of his books, Owen Gindrick describes and shows a picture of a machine that was built during the 20th century to show this. On one side of the machine, it shows the movements of the planets using Ptolemy's model, and on the other, the Copernican model. There's a glass plate in the front of each one so you can see the gears move and the inner workings of each model. The inner workings of the two models are radically different, but the resulting movements of the planets were identical. Therefore, the theories are different, but the empirical facts are the same for both. Said another way, the two theories were, in fact, empirically identical. Second, I have a long interest in celestial navigation. On a website dedicated to it, the author of the website argues that the first step in celestial navigation is to assume that Ptolemy got it right. Why in the world would she say that? The woman who runs this international celestial navigation site is a very interesting person. I have interacted with her over time. She just got her PhD in philosophy of science from Yale. She lives on a boat, spends a lot of her time sailing the North Atlantic. The only point at which we got in trouble is she is Catholic. And when she read my book, she was not happy of how I presented the Catholic perspective. But other than that, we got along quite well. But anyway, why would she make that argument? that the first thing you need to assume in celestial navigation was Ptolemy got it right. Well, again, the point is, both these theories yield identical results. Ptolemy's equations are much easier because you assume the Earth is stationary, so you don't have to account for it moving. So only one thing is moving. The planets and stars move, not the Earth as well. In Copernicus's theory, you have to compute the motion in the Earth in addition to all the apparent motions of the bodies. My point is that the theories both yielded the same results, and Ptolemy's equations are used today for celestial navigation simply because they're simpler to make the calculations. Therefore, if the conclusion is your focus, either theory will do. Neither one is better than the other. So my point is that both theories yielded the same results, so who cares what theory you accept? To me, this brings us to the heart of the Copernican revolution. Even though the two theories were empirically identical, the Copernicans were arguing their theory was correct and Ptolemy's was wrong, even though they lacked the empirical evidence to make their case. To the Copernicans, selecting between these two theories was an intellectual exercise based on making judgments. It was the Catholic Church that argued against them, claiming that we ought to stick with Ptolemy until empirical evidence showed that Ptolemy was wrong. Modern science, like the Catholic Church, would argue the same, that until the empirical evidence is presented supporting one theory over the other, you're in no position to claim one of them being true. The methods of modern science are aimed to remove intellectual judgment and replace them with statistical tests. In fact, modern science is less interested in any theory than they are in the test of hypotheses about facts. In their view, it's the test that's the heart of science, and the test removes all human judgment and biases from the analysis. It's the basis that we would claim that science is more objective and certain than other pursuits. Science, in their view, can be expressed as knowledge without a knower. It's the method that guarantees the result, not the skill of any individual scientist. Therefore, it seems to me that science has been reduced to a technique conducted by technicians. There is no sense of creativity, no individual accomplishment in it. I can't figure out why anyone would want to do modern science. I didn't want to do it any longer once I understood it. Science has simply become a technique conducted by technicians. But I also have a more profound criticism. The so-called method of science itself is not defensible. The claim that science is testing hypotheses and yields more objectively certain results is fallacious. I made this argument a lot. A lot of people in this room could now probably make it better than I can. So I'll skip those details. And if there's questions about that, for any who can't give it to me better than I can give it to you, we'll talk about it after. But anyway, there are three major problems that I would argue with the modern science view. One is that science separates facts and values. The second one is science deals with objective facts. I don't think there's such a thing as an objective fact. Third, one just opens their eyes or takes a dial reading. The mind is passive when those activities happen. There's nothing in the mind of a researcher that affects those results. The main thing over the years that I've learned is that from a liberal arts perspective, the research university perspective is not defensible. This seems like an outrageous claim because it's undeniable that the research content of science has increased immensely in the last century or more. The research university perspective would claim that the immense increase in knowledge is all the evidence anybody needs to refute my claim. This is the only relevant issue from their perspective. While that's true that the empirical content of science has increased tremendously, it's also the case that scientific theories have not radically changed in about 100 years. Since the development of relativity theory and quantum mechanics and physics, little theoretical change has occurred in modern science. Also, in the research university model, little theoretical work is actually done anymore. Most scientists are testing hypotheses to determine the facts. I would argue that the great increase in known facts about the world is important, but only in the context of the development of better theoretical formulations of nature. All the increase in facts has not led to much advancement in our scientific theories, and that's the real measure of science. I've shown that the research university perspective on education is not defensible in the realm of science itself. I've said nothing about other deficiencies that the research university has, such as not educating virtuous citizenry, not helping individuals understand the meaning of life. Yet it's ironic that the research perspective is on the verge of completely eliminating the liberal arts perspective in education. I view this as probably the greatest crisis in education in the last 2,000 years. Within the Gutenberg curriculum, I've learned it's best to focus on the philosophy of science within a liberal arts curriculum. This integrates science into other realms of inquiry. I would argue that this is the fundamental issue for Western culture to address. Scientists need to have a clear picture of what science is, its methods, its limits, and its role in culture. Claiming that science is the only show in town isn't good for science if that claim isn't true. Our students still learn the major elements of theories and some of the tools of modern science, but these are secondary issues from our perspective. The specifics of a field can be picked up quite quickly with a solid framework in place to build on. I'm sure that many will view my criticisms as anti-scientific. I would claim just the opposite. If science is claiming to be something that it's not, or if it's defining itself as a method that's not defensible, and it's claiming to play a role in culture it can't fulfill, I think these scenarios are all ultimately not good for science. I'm all for science, but a defensible science built on the foundation the Copernicans built, not on the modern foundation that's directly opposed to the Copernican Foundation. Thanks.
So questions and answers for a couple minutes.
What's the thing I'm supposed to be able to tell you better than you can tell me?
The critique of the view that science is testing hypotheses, and through the test of those hypotheses, science comes to more objective and certain knowledge than any other fields. Yeah. Having taken the science seminar, maybe we should go back and do the 2-year exam again.
You made the claim, I think, that you said scientific facts are like impotent or turgid without scientific theories.
Uh-huh.
What are you conceiving of the difference between those things being?
Well, if you ask most scientists what is a fact, they will claim that a fact is an observation you make when the mind is passive, so it's affected by no biases in the mind. So the scientific method is designed to eliminate any values, any ideas in the mind of the scientist that could affect the outcome. So their claim is that facts, in that sense, are objective and stand alone. You just see them. The opposite claim is facts only exist, really, and they only have meaning within the context of a theory. So, for example, one question you could ask the first observer is, well, why are you even looking at that observation? What is it that led you to collect this information as opposed to this information? The point is, there's something going on that you're bringing to it. For the scientist to claim there's nothing there, it's purely a passive empirical thing being done to your mind, so that no values or biases or ideas that you have enter the process in any way, it's just a false claim. It's not true.
To whom are you primarily responding? Because, I don't know, it strikes me that many practicing scientists would not recognize themselves in your characterization of them. Especially with respect to the lack of like personal involvement in mm-hmm. the practice of science. Maybe on a purely philosophical level, their mm-hmm. philosophical framework assumes that the method is going to assure the right results, and that their role is purely mechanical. Mm-hmm. That may be their underlying kind of formalized philosophical position, but I think the actual practice of it, maybe speaking from not from clear experience, but just from a sense, I doubt most scientists would recognize themselves in your description. So,
I think that's fair. I don't think I would have recognized myself in that 30 years ago, and I still have enough sense of what that looks like since I still interact with a lot of those same people that are in their perspective. Many of them would say that, oh sure, my values and biases, they're there. But what they want to argue is that the method of science itself guarantees that those don't enter the results. They would argue, with few exceptions. Now, once you get to quantum mechanics or something where just doing the observation affects the outcome, that's different at that level. But other than at that level, for instance, notice whether a scientist uses the word data or they use the word information. The word data means objective fact, not influenced by any criteria. So if they use the word data rather than the word information, they're implying that data are better than information, because data are collected in a way that's unbiased. So many of them would make an argument that, yeah, there's values in stuff, but once we do the method, once we collect data, then that's better information than other people would have. And on that basis, science is more objective and certain than other endeavors. I've never run into a scientist who would make any other claim. So, for instance, scientific research that's done and collected and then published in journal articles, that's called peer-reviewed literature. If it's not peer-reviewed in a journal article meeting the standards of the method, it's called gray literature, and it's meant to be derogatory, meaning it's second class, can't be used as any kind of evidence. No scientist would ever do gray literature. So, I think a lot of scientists probably would object to what I'm claiming they hold, but yet I think their position is, in order to be coherent, the one that I presented. I'd like to meet a scientist that had a different take, but I haven't met one yet.
So that would be a case of philosophical sloppiness and not operating with a philosophical consistency that would recognize, themselves as what you are responding to.
Yeah, well, and part of the reason they wouldn't respond is, remember, my experience wasn't unusual, it's typical. I never in any science class through 7 years of graduate school, I never took a class on what is science. I never took a philosophy class looking at the methods of science or asking anything about its limits. That's not unusual. I don't think you can find many science students who have any philosophy at all. So in part, they've never thought about it because they've never had to address that question. What is science? It's what my professor does. That's what it is. What's the method that's used? I'm here to learn how to test this hypothesis. My professor's teaching me how to do that. I don't know if that's answering your question real well, but like I say, I think it's fair to say that most scientists would object to my characterization of them, but I think if pushed, they would have to agree that in the end that at least I'm consistent about what they say, given what they're claiming about their what science is and what role it should play.
How do you think math fits into all this, the study of math?
One of the major activities in science is finding the patterns in science. That's been a piece of science since the pre-Socratics and a foundation of a lot of our investigation of what we'd call science. So we're looking for patterns. I think mathematics is a language that helps us capture and express patterns. That's one of the major pieces. I don't know, Chris, would you help me out here? I haven't taken his class yet, so.
Base analog models of the universe in your mind. So that if you have an idea, you can test it, it will fail, and you can throw it away before you have ever mentioned it to anybody and you didn't spend any money doing it. That's what it does. It sets up a model that tries to predict what the outcome will be in the real world. And the question is, does the outcome come out to be predicted? And if it doesn't, it doesn't. But when engineers build things, they repeatedly make things break until they find the smallest piece that doesn't break. And they can do that by building the pieces, or they can do it by doing it in their head with math. And it's a lot cheaper to do it in your head with math. So that's largely what math is trying to bridge, create, be able to create without actually having to spend the money on creating.
Yeah. That's interesting. My father-in-law works in rockets and things of that sort. And he mentioned that in the 50s, he went to England for a while, and they didn't have a lot of money, so they spent a whole lot of time doing math, where the Americans in the 50s had a whole lot of money, so they didn't spend much time with the math. They just went out and built stuff and blew it up.